Good evening and welcome to South Sudan in Focus on the Voice of America. I'm John Tanza on this live broadcast from Studio 14. Here are some of the top stories making news across Sudan and South Sudan this Thursday, September 28, 2023. The U.S. Treasury Department sanctions Sudan's former foreign minister for fueling the ongoing conflict in his country.
I think the U.S. is frustrated, and I think now, since the 2 weeks ago, they also announced sanctions against Abdelrahim Dagalo, the second man in command of the RSF. It appears now they are expanding using those sanctions.
And South Sudan's National Army and forces loyal to the country's first vice president struggle over positions in the country's command structure of the newly created unified forces.
Once we get the confirmatory report from all the regional verification heads, then of course the next step would be the redeployment or the deployment.
We'll have these stories and more coming up on South Sudan in Focus. We first go to Moscow, where Reuters reports that the Russian President Vladimir Putin said relations between Russia and South Sudan were developing intensively. Speaking on Thursday at a meeting with the South Sudan President Salva Kiir in Moscow, Putin noted that Russia was one of the first countries to recognize the sovereignty and the independence of South Sudan. Putin told President Kiir, quote, "I must say we believe that we have a lot to do, primarily in the area of economic development," end of quote. Reuters reports that President Kiir said he was happy for the warm welcome and stressed that he was in Moscow as an opening for long work in the future. South Sudan was one of the African countries present at the Russia-Africa Summit in St. Petersburg. The meeting between the two leaders took place as Russia hunts for more allies amid the military campaign in Ukraine. A row between the South Sudan People's Defense Forces and the Sudan People's Liberation Army in opposition, loyal to South Sudan's first vice president, Riek Machar, over allocation of positions in the command structure is threatening to delay the deployment of the unified forces. The SSPDF spokesperson alleges that SPLA-IO rejected 139 positions. But SPLA-IO spokesperson accuses the National Army of taking unilateral actions. For VOA News, Dimo Silva Aurelio reports from Juba.
The Joint Defense Board, composed of military officers from the SSPDF, SPLA-IO, and SOA, issued an order 2 weeks ago asking all the unified forces who graduated a year to report to their training centers for verification and possible deployment. Major General Lul Ruai Kwong is the SSPDF spokesperson and a member of the Joint Defense Board. He says the forces have responded and military officials are screening individuals for suitability in the army.
Once we get the confirmatory report from all the regional verification heads, then of course the next step would be the redeployment or the deployment. We made it very clear anyone who misses verification is not going to be deployed. And whoever misses deployment won't be allowed to join second phase.
Kwong says in June, 106 command positions were allocated to the SPLM-IO, 33 to the South Sudan Opposition Alliance, or SOA, and the SSPDF retained 211 positions. Colonel Lampol Gabriel, the SPLA-IO spokesman and a member of the Joint Defense Board, says the SSPDF did not follow the terms of the 2018 peace agreement.
The agreement says that this needs to be distributed, the position needs to be allocated fairly and by committee. You know, just like what happened to the high command when the position were allocated by the Sudan delegation that came here. Just like also the political position that was given to the SPLM-IG and also the SPLM-IO and so on. They were not given by the SPLM-IG to the SPLM-IO, no.
Kwong says the matter has been referred to the principal signatories of the 2018 for a final decision. The peace agreement states that the strategic defense and security review process shall be comprehensive, inclusive and transparent and supported by the principles and strategies of national interest in promoting and defending the sovereignty and dignity of the country and its people. VOA contacted the military spokesman of SOA, Brigadier Ibrahim Samir David, who also represents SOA in the Joint Defense Board. Samir says he has been out of the country and would comment on the stalemate after gathering more information. For VOA News, I am Dimo Silva Aurelio, reporting from Juba.
Journalists and researchers in South Sudan say they face difficulties accessing information from government institutions. The Commissioner of Information says several challenges, including shortages of personnel in government institutions, hinder access to information. For VOA News, Wake Simon Wudu reports from Juba.
The International Day of Access to Information is marked on September 28th every year. Mathiang Sirilo, the editor-in-chief of Almogif Arabic newspaper in Juba, says it's easier getting tips on corrupt deals in government institutions, but officials in charge of access to information fear journalists.
It's easy to go to the access for information and give them the letter that you need and to get access for information on some issues. But it's difficult to them to force that official to give the statement. So we need something to be more strong, something that to let them give us a lot of information with documents. And
another journalist with the English Daily, the Downer newspaper, says poor internet connectivity coupled with lack of mobile phone services in some parts of the country hinder journalists from accessing information. Simon Deng says getting information from government officials and citizens in some parts of South Sudan can be a daunting task.
To call in areas like Unity State, you can call, but you find that there's interference. You are talking to someone, but the information you are getting is off and on, especially when it is mobile communication. Or what do you have to do? They need to work on the issues of internet, the issues of mobile communication, that accessibility need also to be worked on, the issue of broadening the way of access.
South Sudan's Commissioner for Information admits several factors impede access to information from government institutions. Moigan Duro says his commission is creating awareness amongst the information officers at various government institutions, including law enforcement agencies, about the importance of access to information.
This one is still a challenge because of so many problems. Most of the information officers not yet trained, and some do not know their roles, and we are putting effort into this with our partners so that we train them. This is going to ease access to information.
Speaking at an event to mark the International Day of Access to Information earlier today in Juba, Yath Awan Yath, Undersecretary in the Ministry of Information, calls on South Sudanese to embrace peace.
It is enough. Never again should we resort to fighting as a means of resolving our differences. But differences, be it at the political, community, or household level. Let us rather use the old age wisdom of talking, dialoguing, till we find a solution. It takes time, but avoid losses of life, losses of infrastructure.
The UN General Assembly proclaimed September 28th as the International Day for Universal Access to Information in October 2019. The country representative for the UN Cultural Agency, or UNESCO, in South Sudan, Julius Banda, says internet has boosted access to information.
As we head into a super election year, UNESCO is appealing to governments to ensure that access to information is protected, including access to the internet. The ability to access information has never been more critical to the health of our democracies.
Article 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information and ideas through any media, regardless of borders. For VOA News, I'm Wake Simon Wudu in Juba.
From Juba, we move to Sudan, where officials say officials are expressing concern over the spread of cholera across the country. Hetman Mohamed Ibrahim, Sudan's Minister of Health, confirms 18 deaths and more than 200 cholera cases in Al-Gadarif State. He says other diseases such as dengue fever and malaria are also on the rise in Khartoum, Darfur, and other parts of the country. For VOA News, Michael Atit reports from Juba.
Minister Ibrahim says cases of dengue fever, malaria and watery diarrhea have increased in Gadarif, Khartoum and in North Darfur State in recent weeks. He told VOA via a messaging application that the ongoing fighting in the country has crippled healthcare system, leading to severe shortage of medications. He says the dengue fever cases were confirmed in 8 cities across Sudan.
Confirmed cases of dengue exceeded 700 and 8 cases have died. Fortunately, about 80 to 90% of these cases are counted under critical lines. They only needed some rest and were given some painkillers such as Panadol, more liquids and drips.
The nearly six-month conflict between army and the rapid support forces has affected healthcare system in Sudan. Sudanese health officials said between 70 to 80% of the hospitals in Khartoum have closed due to continued fighting, adding that both warring parties have turned some health facilities into military bases. The minister says cases of acute diarrhea were recorded in Gadarif. He adds that health authorities are working to contain the situation.
Many cases were confirmed through laboratories in many parts of Gadarif State. Till Wednesday morning, about 270 cases were confirmed and about 18 of them died from the disease.
Ibrahim says efforts to combat disease-transmitting mosquitoes have been intensified to reduce transmission rates significantly. Officials in Al-Fashir of North Darfur State say malaria cases have surged to 13,000 amid a severe shortage of medicines due to the ongoing fighting. Ahmed Mohamed Duma, Deputy Director General of Health in North Darfur State, told Al-Hadas TV channel on Tuesday that the number of people infected with malaria in Al-Fashir has increased significantly. Duma explained that the situation is worsened by a severe shortage of malaria medicines for children under 5 years of age.
Since the start of the conflict, we have recorded more than 79,000 cases of malaria, while recently we have recorded about 25 confirmed cases of dengue fever.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs in Sudan says over 1,000 suspected measles cases were reported last week in White Nile State. UNHCR says more than 1,200 refugee children have died in White Nile State due to suspected measles and malnutrition. For VOA News, I am Michael Atit in Juba.
You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. Coming up, U.S. Treasury Department imposes sanction on Sudan's former foreign minister for fueling the ongoing conflict in his country. Stay tuned for more after this break. You are listening to South Sudan in Focus on The Voice of America. The United States Department of Treasury has imposed sanctions on Sudan's former foreign minister, Ali Karti. He is accused of contributing to the outbreak of the conflict between the army and the rapid support forces in April and undermining efforts to reach a ceasefire. The U.S. Treasury has also imposed new sanctions on two procurements and military supply companies affiliated with the RSF. Nabil Biagio spoke with Bakri Al-Madani, a Sudanese political analyst and associate professor of economics at Long Island University, to understand the significance of these sanctions.
It comes as part of the U.S. package to use a carrot and a stick, and this is not new. It has been in the making for a while. U.S. officials, and specifically Secretary of State Blinken, multiple times, he mentioned that the U.S. is open to using different tools. Some of them are diplomatic tools, such as mediating and trying to negotiate a ceasefire. And they have done in the past, multiple times in Jeddah. And unfortunately, all this truce and peace, ceasefire completely collapsed, and none of them could be called to have held even during 8 days. So I think the U.S. is frustrated. And I think now, since the 2 weeks ago, they also announced sanctions against Abdelrahim Dagalo, the second man in command of the RSF. It appears now they are expanding using those sanctions as a way of pushing both sides to come to the table and negotiate a way out of this mess, because there is no end to this war by any side winning it anytime soon. So it makes sense to the U.S. taking some action and using those methods to force the hands of those who are influential, and also specifically by targeting the two RSF companies. This is not just a matter of twisting their arms. It's also limiting their supply chain and making it difficult for RSF to receive assistance from Russia and weapons and advanced type of technology. So you could say it's not just a matter of pushing them to sign a peace agreement or to go for a ceasefire. It's also a way of limiting the capacities of both sides to engage in longer warfare. So eventually they will run out of ammunition, they run out of guns, and they might not be able to continue to fight, even though we know that's a very difficult undertaking to accomplish, given the history of how weapons have been always funneled and channeled to different groups.
Along with sanctioning these companies, RSF-affiliated companies, the Treasury Department also sanctioned Ali Kerti, former Sudanese Foreign Affairs Minister, for, and I quote, let me read you a little bit of that section, for undermining the former civilian-led transitional government and the framework political agreement process, which he contributed to the outbreak of fighting between SAF and the RSF on April 15. He and other hardline Sudanese Islamists are actively obstructing efforts to reach a ceasefire to end the current war between SAF and the RSF, and opposing Sudanese civilians' efforts to restore Sudan's democratic transition. What is your comment on that?
They still use the term Islamist as a way to refer to themselves, but in all reality, this alliance has been in the making since 2011, after the South decided to become state. They are completely to grab of the state, and the motive is to control the resources and use every means as a kleptocrat to use the state as a facade for them to amass wealth. There is not one faction. Ali Kerti is one of the strongest factions, because he happened to be a strong man with a lot of money. And he has been trying, it's not even a secret, to become the de facto leader of the movement. Of course, the movement at this point, it's very hard to imagine what kind of aspirations, what agendas, what ideology it actually espouses to.
Speaking of Ali Kerti not being the only person, it's interesting that Hemeti, the RSF leader, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, in many recordings, he accused the Islamists of igniting this war, and he mentioned Ali Kerti several times, Ali Kerti, Osama Abdullah, and others that he designated as Islamists and the reason behind this war.
He's a man of influence, he's a man of wealth, and he's a de facto emir of the Islamic movement. Specifically, so many of the high-ranking officers in Sudanese army, they respect him and they have their allegiance to him more than they have it for General Burhan. That's not a secret. We know that, because they have a hierarchy of the Islamic organization that is functioning within the Sudanese armed forces. However, it is prudent to be careful and cautious about when Hemeti and talks about the fact that this war is started by Ali Kerti and Osama Abdullah and some of the influential men from the holdover from Bashir regime. This is nothing more than Hemeti trying to hint and suggest to the international community that he's the man who's fighting against the Islamists, and he's supposed to be seen as he has a moral argument for the war. Most of the men leading the war behind Hemeti himself, they happen to be also strong Islamist men.
That's Bakri Al-Madani, a Sudanese political analyst and associate professor of economics at Long Island University. He spoke with my colleague Nabil Biagio this past hour. Gabon's prime minister says international sanctions and pressure for a return to constitutional order could be devastating to the country's economy. He also says the military junta needs time to carry out reforms and a national dialogue before a projected return to civilian rule. Moki Edwin Kinzika reports from neighboring Cameroon.
Speaking to reporters Wednesday, Gabon's Prime Minister Raymond Dong Sima said he wants to remind the world that by seizing power, the military saved the Central African states from a civil war. He said Gabon's political opposition was ready to take up arms and defend its victory after ousted President Ali Bongo Ondimba orchestrated alarming fraud and declared himself the winner of the August 26 presidential election.
Nous prenons la direction de revenir à la norme, à ce qui est normal.
Sima said the international community and friendly countries should be compassionate and stop all sanctions they have already imposed or are planning to impose to press for a return to constitutional order in Gabon. The prime minister said Gabon will have challenges developing its economy and fighting poverty if foreign pressure and sanctions are not rapidly removed. Contested results indicate 69-year-old Albert Ondo Osa, leader of Gabon's main opposition group Alternance 2023, won the August 26 election. But soldiers announced on national television on August 30 they had seized power. The designation of General Brice Clotaire Oligingema, head of the Republican Guard, as president, sparked an international outcry for a return to constitutional order. This week, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken announced the suspension of what he called certain foreign assistance programs to Gabon, pending a review of the circumstances that led to the ouster of President Bongo, who had ruled Gabon since 2009, when he succeeded his late father, Omar Bongo. The State Department said the suspension would not affect U.S. government operations in the oil-producing Central African nation, but did not elaborate on what U.S.-funded programs would be affected or how much money would be placed on hold. Sima, speaking in Gabon's capital, Libreville, said the country's military junta should be allowed to undertake initiatives to restore stability, carry out institutional and legislative reforms, fight corruption, ensure sustainable economic development, and conduct a national dialogue before organizing elections. Sima did not say how much time the military junta needs to carry out the reforms and return power to civilians. Telesphore Ondo is a public law lecturer at Omar Bongo University in Libreville. Ondo tells Gabon State TV that the Central African State military leader needs time and resources to carry out consultations and organize a national dialogue that will reconcile civilians who are angry over the Bongo family's close to 60-year rule that did not develop the oil-producing nation. He says during the consultation and dialogue, the military junta should make it known if it needs 1, 2, or 3 years to return to civilian rule. France, China, Russia, the United Kingdom, and Canada are among nations along with the U.S., that have expressed concerns about the military junta taking over in Gabon and are asking for a return to normalcy. Similar requests have come from the United Nations, two Central African regional blocs, and the African Union. Moki Edwin Kinzeka, VOA News, Yaoundé, Cameroon.
Still on military issues, Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin returns to U.S. Thursday after wrapping up his first tour across the African continent as defense secretary. VOA Pentagon correspondent Carla Bapp is traveling with Austin and has details from his trip.
Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin started his tour in Djibouti, home to the primary U.S. military base on the African continent. There, he met with Djiboutian leaders and the Somali president, whose forces, Austin said, had made more progress against the Al-Shabaab terror group in the past year than the previous 5 years combined. Austin then turned to Kenya. He visited a base in Manda Bay near the Somali border, where a terrorist attack in 2020 killed 3 Americans. Vincent Kimosop is a policy analyst with Sovereign Insight.
Message here being very clear that the war on terror still remains top on the agenda of the American government.
The American and Kenyan defense secretaries signed a 5-year security agreement to support working together against their common terror threat. Austin also pledged $100 million in support of Kenyan security deployments as Kenya prepares to lead a multinational peacekeeping mission to Haiti to combat gang violence. Kenya's Cabinet Secretary of Defense, Aden Duale.
Kenya is ready. Kenya is willing to lead that multinational peacekeeping force that will go to Haiti.
Austin ended his trip on Africa's western coast in Angola, the first U.S. defense secretary to ever visit the country. Both nations are hopeful that Angola can dump Russia as its arms supplier and opt for American-made weapons.
Africa deserves better than outsiders trying to tighten their grip on this continent. Africa deserves better than autocrats selling cheap guns and pushing mercenary forces like the Wagner Group or depriving grain from hungry people around the world.
Austin called out African military juntas without naming Burkina Faso, Gabon, Mali, or Niger. It was his most forceful rhetoric since the military removed Niger's elected president from power in July.
When generals overturn the will of the people and put their own ambitions above the rule of law, security suffers and democracy dies. Militaries exist to defend their people and not to defy them. And Africa needs militaries that serve their citizens and not the other way around.
France decided this week to withdraw its military forces from Niger by the end of the year. And analysts say the U.S. could follow suit should the Nigerian military not return the elected government to power. Bill Raggio is with the Foundation for Defense of Democracies.
Niger has become the key hub, the key center of counterterrorism operations for the U.S. and France in the region. And if this is if it's cut back or if it's reduced or if it's ended, it will. There is no other assets in the region that the U.S. can use.
The U.S. has so far kept its forces in Niger, but the Pentagon has declined to conduct counterterror operations with Niger's military. Carla Babb, VOA News. Luanda, Angola.
That's all we've prepared for you this Thursday, September 28, 2023. We'll now leave you with Emi Yore and the song Maratabet.
Managing a family is a secret thing, you know. About Maratabet, Maratabet, oh, oh,
Anasa Sambala,
yeah, yeah, Maratabet,
Mabidoro, Gloria Sambala, yeah, yeah, yeah,
Maratabet,
Mabilibis, Libisa Sambala,
yeah, yeah, Maratabet, oh,
Marata Saburwa, Marata Ikira,
Wala Pilai, Banata Sena, Deka, Dirminum, Biga Karaban, Itabishu, Alala Fiambio,
We've been listening to Emi Yore and the song Maratabet. I'm your host, John Tanza, on this live broadcast from Studio 14 here in Washington. On behalf of our producer, Kwame Ofori, and engineer, Kayla William, we wish you a good evening. Remember to join us tomorrow for another edition of South Sudan in Focus from the Voice of America.